Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Howard Burton. I'm Executive Director of Perimeter Institute, and it's wonderful to see all of you here this Saturday morning to kick off our festival. At least it would be if the lights weren't shining in my eyes and I could actually see some of you. It's my pleasure, my very great and distinguished pleasure, to introduce John Rigdon. John is a noted and celebrated Einstein scholar and is extremely in demand this year with the anniversary of Einstein's miracle year in 2005, that is to say the anniversary, the 100th anniversary from 1905, not only because of John's erudition and his knowledge, but also because of his book, Einstein 1905, which he has written, and I can have a little promotion here. So for those of you who don't have this book yet, Einstein 1905, The Standard of Greatness, I would strongly recommend it. John Rigdon is not only the author of this particular book from Harvard University Press, he's an honorary professor of physics at Washington University in St. Louis. He received his BS from Eastern Nazarene College and his PhD from Johns Hopkins University. Upon completion of his graduate work, he was a postdoc at Harvard. He served on the faculties of Eastern Nazarene, Middlebury College, University of Missouri, St. Louis. And in 1987, he joined the American Institute of Physics, where he served as the director of physics programs. His scholarly work has been in the area of molecular physics and the history of science, which is an interesting combination, I'm sure you would agree. His professional activities have been at the national and international levels. He was editor of the American Journal of Physics from 1975 to 1985. In 1992, he was the director of development of the National Science Standards Project at the National Academy of Sciences. In 1995, he was elected chairman of the History of Physics Forum of the American Physical Society. He served on numerous committees of the American Association of Physics Teachers, the American Physical Society, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the National Academy of Sciences. He has served as an NSF consultant to India in 1968 and 1969, was the United States representative to the International Science Exhibition in Rangoon, Burma in 1970, a Fulbright Fellow to Burma in 71 and to Uruguay in 1975. He is also the author of Physics and the Sound of Music, Rabi, Scientist and Citizen, and Hydrogen, the Essential Element. He has edited most of The Good Stuff, Memories of Richard Feynman, as well as several collections, including the Macmillan Encyclopedia of Physics and the Macmillan Encyclopedia of Elementary Particle Physics, where he has served as editor-in-chief. Currently, he is co-editor of the scholarly journal Physics and Perspective, and he is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the American Physical Society, and holds an honorary Doctor of Science degree from Denison University. Very recently, this August, in fact, he was selected for the very prestigious Millikan Award for Science Teaching by the American Association of Physics Teachers. There's one other thing to say about John on a personal note, and that is, well, I was many, many years ago traveling around North America and Europe talking to people about, in fact, how to build this place. He was one of the people I spoke with, and his comments and passionate words about the importance of outreach, I think, played a very strong role in the development of what we've created here. So to some extent, John is, in fact, responsible for John being here. And with that, I would like to formally introduce John Rigdon.
This is a great privilege and joy to be here for a number of reasons. Canada is a good neighbor. I wasn't going to say this, but I want this audience to know that there are a lot of people in the United States who are not happy with what's going on in the United States these days. So here we are, and I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be at the Perimeter Institute. It is becoming and has become a well-known center. I'm aware of it for a number of reasons. I had actually forgotten the conversation I had with Howard until this morning he reminded me. But most of all, I'm happy to be here because this is 2005. And this is the centenary of a tremendous outpouring of creative activity by one man. One man, Albert Einstein. He said, "A storm broke loose in my mind." Now, I want to start with a quiz. And I don't want you to talk. I want you to raise your hand. So the first question is, who is this? How many know? One. All right, I only saw one hand. Who is this? Raise your hand if you know. Well, all right, who is this? How many know? You see, it is amazing. These three men all died in 1955. They all won Nobel Prizes. Thomas Mann wrote The Magic Mountain, a very highly regarded novel. Nobody won. One person recognized Thomas Mann. That's not surprising. This is a little surprising. Fleming discovered penicillin. And it's likely that there are family members of you in this audience for whom penicillin played a decisive role, and perhaps for you yourself. And yet, the face of Fleming rings no bell. But when you come to this one, everyone knows. Now, one of the questions, look, I'm going to be with you for a bit. I don't know how much overlap there's going to be between this group and the next group. It's going to be a continuing story. So if, in any event, one of the objectives that I want to achieve is to answer the question, why is Einstein so highly regarded? I think I rarely, in fact, I never, hardly ever use the word unique. But I do believe that Einstein occupies a unique place in the mind of 21st century citizens. He's been dead 50 years. But in a real sense, he walks among us still today. Why is it that mamas and daddies hold up the arm of their child and say, "She is no Einstein, but," trying to make the point that the child is a pretty bright child? Why is it that football commentators, in trying to make the point about the intelligence of a particular player, will say, and this was Joel Theismann, I don't know if you know him, but he said about this player, "He's no Norman Einstein, but." Now, you see, that's amusing on a couple levels. I mean, everybody knew what Joe meant. Doesn't matter, he made his point. So, why is it that Einstein is the standard of greatness? Why is he held up? That's a question that I want to answer. I went to a commercial shop where I have to get new eyeglasses. This was just a couple days ago. And it happened to be the 27th of September. You know what that is? That is the 100th anniversary to the day for that famous equation E equals mc squared. That happened to be. So I said to the woman behind the counter, I said, "You know what this is? This is September 27th. She said, "Yeah, I know." And I said, "But how about, what do you know happened 100 years ago today, right now today?" "I don't know." I said, "Probably the most famous equation of all, E equals, and then she said, mc squared. And I said, that's right. I said, what does it mean? She said, I don't know. She knew the equation, and I said, who was responsible for the equation? Oh, that was Einstein. So you see, without knowing a lot about what he did, clearly his fame is rooted in what he did. But not many people have much knowledge about what he did, and yet here he is still, the person that people look up to and people hold up as a standard. So, all right, the question is why? So in today and tomorrow, I'm going to lay the groundwork for answering that question. You may not agree with my answer. That's okay. All right. But today, the purpose of today is, now, 1905 started in March. But Einstein, while he did essentially pop out of a vacuum, he was unknown. He was connected with no university. He was not even part of the community of physicists. He worked as a third-class clerk in a patent office in Bern. And here he suddenly appeared. I will suggest that while he popped out of a vacuum, he did not pop into a vacuum. Where Einstein stood in 1905 was a very provocative environment, pregnant with potential. And that's what I want to talk about today a bit. I think you'll understand it all, and I think you'll see why it's important. Okay, physicists in 1905, let's say at the beginning of 1905, stood around what essentially was a banquet table with a range of dishes on the table, adorning the table. And all of these dishes had labels in a sense. I'm going to put labels on them. We're going to talk about that. And these dishes were awaiting attention. Where did these dishes come from? Well, of course, they came from the 19th century. And I want to talk about the 19th century because it was in an incredible, incredible century for physics. We get quite proud of what has happened in the 20th century, and we have the right to be proud. But 20th century physics stands shoulder to shoulder with 19th century physics. The 19th century laid a tremendous foundation for 20th century physics. Let me just explain that a bit. In 1801, which is right at the beginning of the 19th century, Thomas Young, a physician, showed that light was a wave. The nature of light. What is it? What is light? It's a wave. And by a wave, you know, because you, how close do you live? Let's see, what's the closest, Lake Erie? What's the closest to Waterloo? Tell me, what? From here, what body of water? What? Right in the middle, okay, well, so you've been probably to the shore of one of these and you've seen the waves come in and you know that the wave is where there's a crest. Well, a wave is something that has crests and troughs in a consistent pattern. And light is a wave with crests and troughs. And those crests and troughs can be dramatically demonstrated. It is for real. Nobody doubted it after Thomas Young. What kind of wave? Nobody knew. But in 1888, 87 years later, Heinrich Hertz showed convincingly that it was an electromagnetic wave. Now, it doesn't matter what that is, but it was an electromagnetic wave. And from that point on, The nature of light was a part of the archives of physics. Everybody knew what it was, without any doubt. So the wave nature of light and the electromagnetic nature of light was done in fulfillment during the 19th century. But go on. You know about electricity. The Greeks knew about electricity. The Greeks knew about magnetism. And here was magnetism, and here was electricity. Two separate phenomena. Certain things attracted each other and repelled each other. And over here, certain kinds of particles or certain kinds of lodestones or bar magnets, you know, they had ends that attracted and ends that repelled, you know, two things. In the 19th century, these two things were brought together and shown to be a unified phenomenon, a unified system, where no longer is it electricity and no longer is it magnetism, it's electromagnetism, because it's the same in one thing. I mean, it's they go together. Electromagnetism, everything electrical in your world and everything magnetic in your world essentially was brought to completion. We understand that stuff. 19th century physics. Thermodynamics, matter, material objects respond to thermal influences in particular ways. And the laws of thermodynamics, too, in the 19th century, very completely identified and demonstrated and was able to predict how material objects responded to increases in temperature, to the addition of heat. All of that was brought to completion in the 19th century. Let me just say that the laws of thermodynamics have their roots in matter, in the material world. But it makes absolutely no assumptions about what matter is. Doesn't matter. Matter can be anything. And the laws of thermodynamics are good, independent of what the nature of matter is. Okay? Brought to completion. Well, one other thing. Oh, the conservation of energy. Energy, the energy principle. I mean, is there, you ask physicists for east to west, north to south, all around. What is the most important concept of physics? And without, I will say without doubt, and I think that's true, the answer you will get is energy. The concept of energy. That was 19th century. And that was essentially, energy conservation was shown to reign over all of science. We'll come back to that. Finally, the kinetic theory of matter. That matter consists of atoms, and that these atoms, let's say in a gas, are in motion. And more than that, they are in random motion, zigzagging around and moving chaotically this way and the other and so forth and so on. In liquids, they move around likewise, but because of the nature of liquids, they don't have quite the range of motion, but they move around. And in solids, they're fixed in locations, but they wiggle around. So the kinetic theory of matter is consistent all across the three phases of matter. And that was brought, I mean, that was shown to be accurate, really wonderful theory and equations and experiments brought the two together. So coming out of the 19th century, we had all of this. Now, that was 19th century physicists. The way they added to the knowledge base of physics is stunning, but they did more than that. 19th century physicists actually brought physics to the forefront of science. I am going to say that I believe there is a mystique to physics that other sciences do not enjoy. Now, you may not agree because you may be a chemist, but I'm going to ask you something. The next time you're in the grocery store ask the person behind you in line, name a great physicist. And they will name Einstein for sure. They will name Newton. They may name Richard Feynman. They may name Hawking. There's a few. They may name a Galileo. You know, they may know quite a few physicists. Now ask them to name a great chemist. And I predict, anyone have a prediction here? Name a great chemist. Come on. What? Pauling. Bingo! Pauling. But is he known because he was a great chemist or because he promoted vitamin C and was an active promoter of disarmament and peace? He was a public figure, not because he knew he worked on the crystal structures and was a chemist. I question whether he's known as a chemist. But any other chemist? No. If you ask somebody to name a great biologist, they will name Darwin. And beyond that, I don't think they'll name anyone else. Maybe. I don't know. But anyways, you ask physics. There's a mystique to physics, which I may talk about, I'm prepared to talk about, if we can get there later, why that mystique exists. Well, all right. Part of it I'll talk about right now. During the 19th century physicists brought physics to the forefront. And they did this with their Leyden jars, voltaic batteries, wires, compasses, magnets, and Ruhmkorff coils. 19th century physicists with these devices produced electrical displays in auditoria like these, like this, and fascinated audiences in exhibition halls from London to Paris, to Philadelphia, and perhaps Toronto, I don't know. Certainly, there was Michael Faraday in England, Hans Christian Oersted in Denmark, André Marie Ampère in Paris, Alessandra Volta in Italy, and Joseph Henry in the United States, all conveyed to the public their command of electrical phenomena as these shocking showmen manipulated their electrodes. The public became convinced that physicists understood what was behind these sparking devices. And more than that, they became convinced that physicists could control the forces that were at play as the sparks leapt from one item to another. More than that, let's go on. William Thomson used Carnot's theories and Joule's experiments to make the science of thermodynamics the exemplar of a whole new way of doing physics. Einstein himself said that thermodynamics is the example of what a physical science should be. So it was an impressive thing. Thomson was delighted by the way that thermodynamics gave a direction to the universe in time, and how people in general, audiences like this in the 19th century, were familiar and became familiar with heat death. So the ideas became spread through outreach programs like the Perimeter Institute. Very important. As these ideas spread, well, let me give you a couple more. I've already said it, but the conservation of energy, which was clearly stood over all of science, demonstrated that the laws of physics were unusual and that they were decisive in how nature functions and how the world works. So at the end of the 19th century, physics was seen as the foundational science. And if you really wanted to learn about how nature works, people would have said in 1900, you ask physicists. They're the ones. All right, now, the 19th century has something behind it, and I need to talk about that as well. We're still talking about Einstein. But we're talking about the context of Einstein in 1905. 19th century produced a cultural climate that Einstein benefited from. A cultural climate very different from what Thomas Young stood in 1801 when he demonstrated the wave nature of light. The benefits to Einstein were manifold. Thomas Young worked under handicaps in a way, all right? There was no profession in 1801. Physics was done by gentlemen who had means to function independently. I told you, Thomas Young was a physician. He didn't earn a living being a physicist in 1801. But in 1900, because of what had happened in the 19th century, Einstein benefited from that. All right, but the 19th century physicists benefited as well. Two things happened. In the 17th century came a revolution called the Scientific Revolution, and in the 18th century came the Enlightenment. I just want to talk a moment about both of those because they're both important. The Scientific Revolution in the 17th century put science on an empirical footing. For centuries, the terrestrial and celestial domains were completely separated and thought to be different entirely. The celestial domain was perfect, eternal. The terrestrial domain was transient, imperfect. Four elements characterized the terrestrial domain: earth, water, fire, air. One element characterized the celestial domain. Very different. Now, because the heavens were perfect, what kind of path did the planets follow as they orbited the sun? Well, if the heavens are perfect, the only appropriate path was the most perfect geometrical figure, the circle, the perfect, absolute perfect circle. So all the planets moved in circular orbits around the sun. That was a proclamation by authority. The authorities made the assertion that the orbits were circular. Why were there seven bodies in the solar system? Sun, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. That was all known back there. Why were there seven? Do you know why there were seven? Do you know why there were seven? Because you have seven holes in your head. You have two nostrils and two ears and two eyes and a mouth. That's seven. That was some of the authoritative proclamation. There are seven bodies because there are seven holes in the head. All right. So from going in the Scientific Revolution, the transformation from insight truth by authority to insight truth by empirical confirmation, that occurred. Let me give you an example. Johannes Kepler in 1600 joined Tycho Brahe in Denmark. Tycho Brahe was the greatest naked-eye astronomer of antiquity, and he was not in 1600, is not antiquity, but all astronomy was done pretty much by naked eye. Well, he was the greatest. His data were very, very accurate. Kepler was a very good mathematician and essentially a theoretician. He would have had a home at Perimeter Institute, and they would have been proud to have him. When Kepler joined Brahe, Brahe gave Kepler the problem of Mars to fit Brahe's measurements, determined positions of Mars over time. That may mean over time, over years, to fit those positions to an orbit. That was the challenge. Kepler said, "I'll have it done before the end of the year." Well, he approached it in the orthodox way, a circle. After 5 years, he was still struggling. And after 5 years, he finally thought he had it. It was done. He got his circular orbit. And then he discovered a new piece of data from Tycho's work. A new one, a new position. And it didn't fit. It did not fit. Now, it was only off by 8 seconds of arc. Tiny discrepancy, a tiny discrepancy. And in the mindset of what went before, they would have ignored that 8 seconds of arc. In fact, Kepler himself said he could have swept that under the rug. But no. What Kepler did, and he said this, since it was not possible to ignore them, those 8 minutes, I'm sorry, I said 8 seconds, a little bigger than that, 8 minutes, sorry. Since it was not possible to ignore them, those 8 minutes point the road to a complete reformation of astronomy. Think of that. He had it 5 years. Now a data doesn't agree. He says we have to start again. The data, the evidence does not agree. And that did lead to a complete reformation of astronomy. Kepler's three laws came out of that. Three laws of planetary motion, which students learn today at Waterloo University. Well, Newton built on Kepler. It would be a delight to know exactly, moment by moment, step by step, how Newton came to the point that he felt he could bridge the terrestrial and the celestial. How he arrived at the point, the abstract idea, that every mass in the universe attracts every other mass in the universe. And I say in the universe because this was the first universal law, and it was presented as a universal law of physics. Every mass out there attracts every other mass out there. And he didn't leave it there. He gave us a way of calculating exactly in numbers what the magnitude of that attraction was. And with that calculation, a lot of things on Earth suddenly became understood. So Newton's gravitation and Newton's mechanics became an umbrella under which a lot of things took on understandable form. Well, Newton laid bare this law of nature. There were two anomalies, the planet Mercury and the planet Uranus. By that time, Uranus had been discovered. Before that time, Saturn was the last known planet. That was the seven holes in your head. Uranus would, of course, screw that idea because we don't have 8 holes in our head. What do we do with Uranus, the seventh planet? Is it seven? Yes, seven. Well, Mercury and Uranus behaved anomalously. And they have behaved anomalously for 150 years. They didn't fit for 150 years. Did physicists say, oh, it's just a theory, and toss it out? No. No. As I have said, the umbrella was big. And many, many things fit under that umbrella very comfortably. And so they were patient, and they waited. Well, Albert Einstein took care of Mercury. 70 years before Einstein took care of Mercury, two astronomers, one from England and one from France, took care of Uranus. What they assumed was that there might be another body out there that was attracting Uranus. And because of this attraction, the anomalies in the orbit of Uranus, in the motion of Uranus, could be explained. An unknown object. So they calculated. John Couch Adams sent his result to England. The astronomer Royal Airy put it in his drawer and ignored it. Jean Leverrier sent his results to Paris. They more or less ignored it too, so he sent his results finally to Berlin, to the Berlin Observatory. The Berlin Observatory had just completed a star map, an updated star map accurate. They knew the stars, man. Well, on the very night of the very same day that the Berlin Observatory received Leverrier's results, and let me tell you what he sent them. He didn't say, look in the sky somewhere, you know. Here's what he sent them. A pinpoint location. Right ascension, 22 hours, 46 minutes. Declination, minus 13 degrees, 24 minutes. A pinpoint. Look at that pinpoint. On the very night, as the very same day that they received those numbers, Galileo put the Berlin telescope up, looked through the eyepiece, and described a star of eighth magnitude. And his assistant said, it's not on the map. And Dallier said, put it on the map. That was Neptune, the eighth planet. Now, part of the mystique of physics is the ability to take an abstract set of ideas, manipulate those ideas until you come up with a quantitative number, a number, 24 hours, 46 minutes. And then somebody verifies that number, and in the process verifies the logical, abstract, intellectual exercise that took place. I'll tell you, this is the stuff of high drama. Newton's idea was so captivating that it spawned, at the end of the scientific revolution, another important period called the Enlightenment. And that has influenced everyone in this room. The powerful methodology of Newton and science excited the people of Scotland and England and France and North America. And they came to recognize that nature was law-like. The Enlightenment was made for Homo sapiens. Homo sapiens is the animal with a big brain, thinks in order to survive. We live, we survive by our wit. We don't have fast feet, we don't have long canines, we don't have sharp claws, we don't have thick fur, we don't have a prehensile tail, we have a big brain. And we survive through our wit. Right? The Enlightenment was made to order for Homo sapiens. Immanuel Kant was asked, what is the Enlightenment? And Kant answered, thinking for oneself. You all want to think for yourself. Well, during the Enlightenment, as I said, habits of mind changed. And the change agent, two big ideas came out, nature and reason. Nature flowed from Newton. Reason flowed from John Locke, the philosopher. People became convinced that nature was law-like, not capricious. There weren't little imps behind trees screwing things up. Nature was predictable and law-like. And how do we discover these laws? How do we gain insight? How do we determine what these laws are? Through human reason. Amazing. When Alexander Pope wrote the couplet, "Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night, God said, let Newton be, and all was light." That's more than just a jingle. Put in context, that was the banner for a new era. And everyone in this room woke up this morning without thinking about it, without knowing it, without any conscious awareness of it, but you all woke up realizing, thinking, believing that nature is law-like and that human reason is the tool to get at those laws. Well, let me just say, habits of mind are not produced by garage door openers and cell phones. Habits of mind are produced by ideas. And the idea that nature is law-like, an enlightenment idea, and that reason can get at those ideas still are at the root and the foundation of the thinking, certainly of Western cultural citizens. Well, all right. Now, I want to say, partly, I'm on the fringe of answering the question of what made Einstein the standard of greatness. I'm not going to answer it, but this is background. Einstein did what he did through the power of his mind. That's impressive. You know, we can watch the world's fastest runner break a record, and we can say, that is terrific. But a cheetah can run faster. A dog can run faster. We can watch the world's fastest swimmer break a record and say, that's terrific, but a porpoise can run faster, swim faster. An otter can swim faster. But if we watch a first-class mind at work, no cheetah can compete. No porpoise can compete. Einstein is a first-class mind. Now, in 1900, they stood around a banquet table. And on this banquet table, as I said earlier, were many dishes. And I'm going to talk just for a moment about these dishes because these are coming back this afternoon and tomorrow. Five dishes that I want to talk. There probably were more dishes than that, but these are the five that Einstein himself addressed in 1905. Let me tell you, in 6 months, 1 week, and 2 days, Einstein wrote five papers that reshaped the foundations of physics. Those five papers were in different areas of physics, and those five papers are good, accurate, today, 100 years later. They stand firm. Quite a guy. Light and matter. This was the one dish that no other physicist seemed interested in. Light and atoms, sorry. Einstein saw something there. And what Einstein saw was the subject of his March paper, the first one of 1905. And we're going to talk about that this afternoon. This paper, March, is the only paper that Einstein himself called revolutionary. And in a word, what he saw was that there was a conflict between the continuity of light waves. Light waves are continuous. Go to Lake Erie, you see the wave coming towards shore, it goes clear down that way and clear down that way, a long wave, okay? Atoms are point particles. When a wave hits a boathouse, it can smash the boathouse because the boathouse has a big cross section and a lot of energy can be transferred to that boathouse. But that same wave passes over a pebble. Doesn't bother the pebble. And Einstein alone, everyone, Einstein recognized there was a problem. When light, with its continuity and atoms with its point-like discontinuity, there was a problem. That was March. All right, let's go on. Thermodynamics and kinetic theory. Workers of thermodynamics believed, and everybody believed, with some trepidation. And this was, now by the way, all of these dishes that come after that, these bottom four dishes, were like lumpy gravy. You know, you add flour to meat sauce to make a thickened gravy and so forth, and sometimes the flour lumps, and the gravy's not so good. Well, all of these dishes were lumpy. Coming out of the 19th century with all that happened, and so quickly, some of these ideas, some of these theories, like thermodynamics and kinetic theory, they didn't blend the way they should have. There were problems between them. Now, what was the problem? The problem was this. Thermodynamics has its roots in matter, how material things respond to heat and temperature and so forth. The laws of thermodynamics were thought to be absolute. Now take kinetic theory. If matter consists of atoms in random motion, and that's what matter is, then you open up the possibility that there will be fluctuations in samples of matter such that the laws of thermodynamics can momentarily be violated. Look, you know what a statistical fluctuation is. I can't give you numbers here in Waterloo. But let's say you know that you can have a string of days in the winter, January, let's say below zero. Correct? You know that, right? That's true, right? Tell me, yes. Yes. Now, I don't know how many days in a row you can have below zero. Lots. Well, I'm going to say, suppose you have 25 days in a row below zero. That's probably a lot. All right? I don't know if ever in history you've had 25 in a row. Well, then I'm going to say 40 in a row. My point is that weather is random, and there can be statistical fluctuations. You know from weather reports, they'll say it's 20 degrees out. That's 2 degrees above normal. Normal? What's normal? Normal is when the atmosphere is acting normally, when those atoms up there and molecules are doing their things in a normal way. But every now and then, there can be a fluctuation, and you get an unusual weather pattern, and it can be below zero for 90 days, you know, maybe not. Anyway, that's a statistical fluctuation. It happens in weather all the time. Well, I will say that in 1900, 1905, no one had ever demonstrated empirically, experimentally, that statistical fluctuations were real. All right, but here was the issue. Are the laws of thermodynamics valid, absolute, or are the laws of thermodynamics just, not just, are they statistical? Are they obeyed statistically? On average, they're obeyed, but they can be violated during unusual times, all right? The next paper, I'm taking these together, mechanics, thermodynamics, and kinetic theory. The issue here was, and by the way, this worried a lot of people. The issue here was that in mechanics, the way atoms move, it doesn't matter whether you look at these atoms moving the way they actually move, or whether you turn time around and look at them running in the opposite direction. Think of it this way. Take a movie of a sample of matter, a gas, let's say, you see atoms moving around. Now run the movie backwards. You can run movies backwards. You know, you see people, and you know it's being run backwards. But when you take this movie of the atoms and run it backwards, you can't tell. It looks just as good as a movie running forwards, all right? That's mechanics, irreversible. I'm sorry, reversible. The laws of mechanics can go backwards in time or forwards in time, it doesn't matter. The laws of thermodynamics are irreversible. Things only go one way. You scramble your eggs, you can't unscramble them. You take two boxes of gas put them together, hydrogen, helium, oxygen, nitrogen, pure. Put them together, open a trap door, in a little while, you'll come back, and you'll find the two boxes, an even mix of hydrogen and helium. And never. You can wait and wait forever and ever. Never will these mixture unmix, and you come back and you see pure hydrogen and pure helium. You'll never see that. That is irreversible. Once they have mixed by themselves, they won't unmix by themselves. Irreversible. Yet, the laws of mechanics say that can happen. If you take the movie of them mixing, you could turn that movie around and laws of mechanics would find it unmixed, unmixed, and pretty soon you'd have pure. So what's the problem? Fundamental problem. All right? Now, those are lumpy dishes. Thermodynamics and kinetic theory didn't go together blending smoothly. Mechanics, thermodynamics, and kinetic theory didn't blend smoothly. Light and the ether. Light comes to us from every star out there, all over the universe. But light is a wave. 1900, everybody knew it was a wave. There was no doubt. Light comes to us from every point in the universe, all through the universe. It needs a medium, something to support the light, something in a sense to push it, the light can push against. This is not good physics language, but that is okay. A medium is needed. Well, they created the medium, was the ether, and the ether filled the universe, all right? Now, very, very, very precise, exacting experiments were performed, the purpose of which was to detect the ether. It failed. You couldn't detect it. Part of the problem. The other problem was, coming out of electromagnetism, unexpectedly, was the fact that there were electromagnetic waves. And when you the theory, without problem, gave you precisely the speed with which these electromagnetic waves moved. 300,000 kilometers per second. Does that mean anything to you? See, I say 186,000 miles per second. But that's because the U.S. has not joined the modern world. What do you say the speed of light is? What? Can somebody tell me what you say the speed of light is? C, yes, but what is the number? What is the number? I can't understand anything you're saying. Howard, what do people here say? Yeah, but people don't. You don't say 3 times 10 to the 10th. I think it's 300,000 kilometers per second. Whether that makes sense to you or not, I don't know. But there it is, a number. What does it mean? You know, when you give a speed, it doesn't mean a damn thing. You have to say, relative to the pavement, I am moving 80 kilometers per hour. You don't say that. You say, I'm going 80 kilometers per hour. But everybody knows. Everybody knows you're not talking about with respect to the sun. Okay? They know what you mean. But you have to have something to refer it to. Now, where is this 300,000 kilometers per hour per second? Where? What does that mean? Well, what it meant was with respect to the ether. So the light had a particular velocity with respect to the ether. Now, light is an electromagnetic wave. That was part of the problem. Okay, so I'm gonna leave that. So this ether, light in the ether, was a problem. It was the June paper. By the way, I didn't say that second and third dish were the April and May papers. I'm going to talk about those tomorrow morning. Those are wonderful papers, wonderful papers. One of them was his dissertation. And the story behind that, you will laugh. I mean, you will find that quite amusing and pathetic. Light in the ether was the June paper. Mechanics and electromagnetism was a June paper, and here was the problem. The laws of mechanics seemed to be good for all observers. A little qualification which I'll make later, but not now. All observers could look at nature, and it didn't matter whether they were moving on the earth or whether they were stationary on the earth. It didn't matter whether they were going up and down. It didn't matter, you know. The laws of mechanics were the same for all observers. The laws of electromagnetism were not. What is going on? And what physicists did was they used the ether and said that the laws of electromagnetism have their valid form in the coordinate system or in the framework of the ether. That's where they're the valid form, all right? Now, what this means is this sets electromagnetism apart as being valid really only in one frame of reference, namely the ether, and something different for every, you know, anytime you're moving in different ways, you have problems, you have different laws of electro. Einstein couldn't tolerate that, and that we'll see in his June relativity paper. One more thing came out of that, and that was the famous E equals mc squared, which you all know. And by the way, many weird things came out of that relativity paper, and that's why people know it. Time is different than you think. We all have our own times. We all have our own spaces. We'll talk about that. But E equals mc squared is just as strange. You know, energy and mass are equivalent. E, energy, equals m, mass, c, speed of light squared. Energy and mass. Multiply the mass of something by c squared, and that's how much energy it represents. Think of that, though. Well, think of that. This has mass. It's tangible. I can grip it. I can throw it at you. There's energy coming from those lights. I'm being illuminated by electromagnetic energy. I can't grab it. But it's there. It's that energy has mass. They're the same. Energy and mass, not the same, but they're equivalent. Well, everything we do is a testimony to E equals mc squared. It lives with us. That was an amazing thing. That was September. And it came in September because he just didn't think of it in June. It would have made a wonderful ending to the June paper. But he came at it later. Well, look. We're going to talk about these five dishes. And what Einstein did is so characteristically Einstein, you're going to be pleased by Mr. Einstein. His insight was just profound and deep. So with that, I'm going to say Einstein is a worthy subject and you're a worthy audience, so I think we should quit. Thank you.
We do have about 15 minutes or so for questions. So for anybody who has questions, please put up your hand. And we have two people with roving microphones on either side of the aisle who will take your questions. So as we're going forwards, perhaps I can ask one question to get things started. My understanding is that that Lord Kelvin mentioned something at the end of the 19th century to discourage people from even bothering going into physics, that everything had been discovered or close to being discovered, or words to that effect. So without commenting directly on that, perhaps...
And say it one more time, I'm sorry, that Kelvin did what?
Kelvin mentioned, my understanding, and I may be wrong, Kelvin had mentioned that roughly everything in physics, there were a few minor things, but basically he was discouraging people from going into physics because it was already a dead field and everything had been discovered and so forth. So rather than commenting directly on that, with that sentiment in mind, perhaps you could speak a little bit or give me a sense as to, of those five lumpy issues that you referred to above, which ones you thought were perhaps the most troubling to the general scientific community, and to what extent people were really bothered by these issues?
Okay, good question. Kelvin was one of the stalwart figures of 19th century physics. His name was William Thomson, and he became Lord Kelvin. An outstanding scientist and human being. He did say, towards the end of the 19th century, and others said as well, that physics was completed. Now remember, here these guys were. And by the way, they were guys. In today's world, you say guys, you know, it means something. But in the 19th century, Madame Curie appeared in 1898. She discovered radium. She appeared right there in the final years of the 19th century. At this moment, I can't think of another woman in physics. So the guys of the 19th century had done so much. Maybe a little arrogance crept in, but they said they thought physics was essentially complete, and all that was needed now was to perfect things and to refine what they had. Now, I want you to think of this. I want you to think of this. Those same physicists could rap on their desk and not have a clue what their knuckles were hitting. They had no knowledge of the material world. They didn't know why the desk stopped their hand. What about the desk? What is it about the desk that when their hands hit it, it stops? So the whole material world was open and waiting. How dumb. You know, how dumb. Let me tell you something interesting. We stand at 2000. There's a very similar situation as way things now stand. If we're correct, this matter, ordinary matter, makes up about 5% of the universe. So we understand about 5% of the universe. And out there is dark matter. We don't know what that is. Out there's dark energy. We don't know what that is. So just like 100 years ago, when the whole material world was open, awaiting, today we stand and about 95% of the material world is open and waiting. Okay, so we're in a very similar situation. Now, which of these attracted the most attention? I would say that physics in 1900, 1905 was obsessed with the ether. Why did the experiments that had been performed provide no evidence of the ether? Light had to have something, and the ether was it. That was a big problem, a big problem. And I shall read something tomorrow morning, I shall read something tomorrow morning where, written in 1900, that picks out this mechanics and kinetic theory, the fact that mechanics is reversible and thermodynamics is irreversible, as the outstanding problem of physics. 1900. So certainly, the ether, the conflict between reversibility and irreversibility, those were certainly on the minds of people. I don't know that the fact that electromagnetism separated itself from mechanics by being accurate only in the ether frame, I'm sure that, I know that bothered some, but it wasn't a major issue. Light and atoms was not an issue at all. So that's roughly, okay? Now, one of you have a question. Yes.
In the printed description of your talk, it referred to physics becoming the queen of the sciences. And that was, to me, provocative because, as you probably know, theology is, or was, is the queen of sciences.
Just a minute. You're going to have to speak up just a little. I don't hear well. I mean, if you heard it. I'm sorry. Let me finish your question. And
the description spoke of physics as the queen of the sciences.
Yes.
And you alluded to that without actually quite saying it this morning.
Uh-huh.
I took it to be provocative because the queen of the sciences traditionally was theology.
Yes.
And I'm curious whether you meant that to be provocative.
I know exactly what you're saying. I will acknowledge now that when I wrote that, I did not think of that. I was not taking a shot at theology at that when I wrote that. I don't know the meaning when theologians say theology is the queen of the sciences. I don't know what they mean by that. You know, we're having, I don't know how much it is a Canadian thing, but right now in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, if you're following it, there's a trial going on. People are calling it the second Scopes trial. And the attempt is being made to bring a different view of how life develops and so forth into the science classroom. Now, I think the most compelling response to that, well, first, two things. I don't think debates help. Debates heat up emotions, but they freeze minds. And the debaters get more and more committed to their position. I think what the science community needs to do, the Perimeter Institute, and I have ideas for this, I have good ideas for this, is we need a long-term strategy. I mean, forever, a way of presenting science in a positive way that will give citizens of the world, a world that is increasingly becoming, in the United States at least, and the United States stands alone in this, more or less, increasingly religious. But science exists at the pleasure of the larger public. If the larger public does not accept the values of science, science is really threatened. So what we need is not something that's going to change minds tomorrow, because we can't do that. We need a long-term strategy, a positive strategy, which puts into place ways of thinking and understanding that will give people, ordinary people, always an alternative, so that when somebody says this was by intelligent design, they can at least have something to think about independently. The way we do things today, they don't. I will tell you, students graduate from their science educations with much to be desired about science. So, but all right, now, what makes science science is that it is a conversation, a dialogue. A conversation is not dialogue the way I use it. You can have a conversation and not have dialogue. Dialogue is when you're really listening to each other. You're really thinking about what each other is saying and being influenced by that, the words. I'm influenced by you and you're influenced by me. That's dialogue. And that's the blood of human relationships, real dialogue. All right? Now, science is a dialogue with nature. You ask questions of nature, and nature gives you answers, absolute gives you answers. Answers in terms of pointer readings, answers in terms of numbers, which you can go back and test in different ways, and you can finally say, I understand you, nature. Thank you for those answers. Now, any frame of thinking that does not allow you to ask nature a question that can be answered empirically. I don't want to hear an answer, there's seven holes in your head. I don't want that answer. That's opinion, whatever it is. I want an answer, 1.75 arc seconds. Do you know where that comes from? That was, I'll come back to that. That was Einstein's prediction of how much light would bend as it passed the sun. 1.75. Einstein didn't say. Einstein asked nature a question. If this is true, how much will light bend as it passes the sun? And he used his theoretical framework and got an answer, 1.75 seconds, arc seconds. Now, did he leave it there? Well, yes, he did. That was 1915, the Great War was on. Sat there for 4 years, but then Eddington went out, matched a total eclipse, and when the total eclipse was, when the totality was complete, he looked up, measured the position of a star, the apparent position of a star, and concluded that light was bent by 1.61 arc seconds. Einstein predicted 1.75. The experiment was 1.61. Not bad. But you see, that's science. How much does light bend, nature? Eddington measured it, and it came back. Real confirmation of a number of things, but that's science. Now, I just say again, and I've asked not many because I don't want to I don't argue with those folks, but I've asked a few. Give me one question that would have an empirical answer that you could ask nature that would support intelligent design. I have, so far I've not gotten one response. So, anyways, any other questions? They say very quick and talk loudly.
At the beginning of your talk, you made a short sense educational background and that he wasn't affiliated with a particular university. I don't remember your exact comments. I'm just wondering if you could say a little more about his background and how he got his ideas accepted on the scientific scene.
All right, a little more about his background and how he got his ideas, right? Oh, that would be tomorrow. I mean, I'll do that, but I'll answer your question because, number one, he was born in 79, so he was a young man in 1900, and he worked in the, well, not 1900, by about 1902, I guess, or three, I cannot forget which. He got the job in the patent office in Bern. It was a wonderful job because he had time. He loved the job, he liked it, he was good at it, and he had time to think, and he did. Now, Einstein, as we will see, saw little asymmetries, little contradictions in things that no one else saw. And they were always at the level of the profound. I mean, he saw deeply. He also had images that were important. As a kid of 16, he had the image of running along beside light as light moved. So you know, get ready, set, go, turn on the flashlight, and as the light starts out, you run along beside it. What do you see? Well, what Einstein saw was a real contradiction. That little image of running along beside light festered in his mind for years. All right? Another type of image. If you jump out of the off the roof of the Perimeter Institute, it takes a second or two or three to get to the ground. And during that second or two or three, you have no weight. I mean, if you're standing on a bathroom scale and you and the scales are falling, you have no weight. There's nothing measured on, there's nothing registered on the bathroom scale. So in terms of measurement, you have no weight. What does this suggest to you? See, a lot of people sort of knew that. What Einstein saw was that there's a connection. When I'm standing on a bathroom scales right here, gravity is pulling me down and the scales register something. But now if my feet are tied to the scales, but I'm standing on the scale, but when I jump up, the scales comes up with my feet, and then I jump off here, during that moment I'm hitting down here, the bathroom scales goes back to zero. So during that time of fall, I weigh nothing. Now what does this mean? This means that gravity and my falling have some connection. My falling cancels out my weight. Okay? Einstein saw something big in that. And out of that came the general theory of relativity. He had an amazing ability to take little images and see very profound things in them. So I don't know if I've answered your question or not. We'll go further with it.
Indeed. I think it's a wonderful time to stop now and thank Professor Rigdon for a very stimulating and informative. I'd also like to remind you that, as mentioned, as advertised, Professor Rigdon will be speaking on three other occasions about the three most, perhaps, groundbreaking seminal papers of the five. You'll be speaking on four, right, sorry, my apologies, on four. And he will be referring to the fifth, as well as being my host at the Bistro Banter session on Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock upstairs. Thank you all very much for coming. I hope to see you during the rest of the festival. Thank you and good day.